Welcome back again to badquaker.com. Today is Monday, December 12th, 2011. This is podcast number 61. My name is Ben Stone. Today, hopefully, if I can get through it, I want to discuss a couple different things. One, I want to discuss the state of human beings in regards to how we deal with one another and dealing with one another on a moral basis. And we can tie this together with the zero aggression principle to a certain extent, but it really is the zero aggression principle, and it's really what it's all about. And so I want to talk about that a little bit, and then I want to hit some of the current news items that are floating around, including the wonderful scandal over the weekend of the Oath Keepers being the point of a myth or an internet myth, I suppose you would call it, about the government questioning people at the Mormon cannery about their customer list and so forth. But before we get into that, I want to go straight for true bad Quaker preaching. I mean, this is like strap yourself in, sit down, strap yourself in, and get your ears ready, because this is what badquaker.com is all about, this topic right here. And that is, you stinking, filthy, disgusting Puritans, I am sick right up to here with you people. Yeah. You think that's too harsh? Did I come off too harsh on that? Was that too rough? I don't think so. I think maybe a baseball bat to the forehead would not be too rough for these stinking, filthy Puritans that rule this almost all of North America. Fortunately, there's still civilized people living in Mexico that mind their own business. Okay, so what am I talking about? Why am I angry? Why am I starting this podcast angry? Let me tell you why I'm angry. I try to isolate myself from people like this as much as possible. And I try to make sure that there are just situations that when I do encounter people like this, I can just turn my back and walk the other way and not have to deal with them. But on occasion, when people are a family and they behave as Puritans, the frustration level is really difficult to deal with for a sane person. And since I'm not a sane person, it's rarely difficult for me to deal with. And again, what am I talking about? Well, I like to blame the Puritans because they essentially invented the theology in the modern terms, but really this goes all the way back to Adam and Eve. I've got a couple of articles. One of them I'm going to link to, and I might even, according to how long this podcast goes, I might even play the audio file for this file. It's called "Am I My Brother's Keeper?" And I may play the audio file at the end of this podcast. I'm not sure. It's according to how long I rant and rave about everything else. And another on the same topic, though, there's a bad Quaker article that I did on the fall, and specifically the origin of sin and what really is sin. I mean, we're, you know, without getting into a big theological thing, without really going into a big deal to you know, pick apart biblical passages and do a lot of things like that, it's my contention that when man abandons natural law, abandons the law that is natural to us, that we are born with, that is embedded within our hearts, when we abandon that and we make up our own laws and we become the lawmaker, when man becomes the lawmaker, he takes the place of God, because God is the source of natural law. So when man takes the place of lawmaker, man places himself in the position of a God as a lawmaker, and that I believe to be the original Adam sin. I believe that Adam, when he took the so-called fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, what he was actually doing is he began making laws. He began placing himself in the position of God, proclaiming himself as the lawmaker. And God is the lawmaker, however you perceive God. I'm not saying necessarily a guy in a robe and a white beard and or whatever. I'm saying whatever it is that you perceive as being God, God is the natural lawmaker for humanity. And when man usurps that, and when man places himself in that position, man is making himself to become a god. And now we get into articles like where I talked about the difference about having the state as God. And this is exactly the theology that I'm talking about, where the state takes that place of God and the state becomes the lawmaker. But that is birthed in this Puritan mentality that man can make God. I'm really too upset to even talk about this. I should turn off the mic and go breathe somewhere in a room for a while, but I'm going to try to pound this out. When man takes on this Puritan theology and he decides that he himself can make laws for other men, then that man, that individual man right there, has taken himself and exalted himself above God and made himself the lawmaker. So when one person, and it doesn't matter who that person is, when you take your finger and you point it at somebody else and you say, your behavior is sinful, what are you doing exactly? Are you not becoming the judge of that man? Okay, let me get back to some reasonable rather than just wild, crazy ranting. If you look at my article, and I'll try to remember to put links to all this. If you look at my article, A Natural View of Rights, Instinct, and Law. Okay, and if you look at, let me click over there and make sure that's the right one. This one actually, A Natural View of Rights, Instinct, and Law has to do with human rights and human laws are instinctual to us, just like certain rights and certain laws are to certain animals. So that actually wasn't the one I was thinking of. Am I my brother's keeper? Here we go. A General Theory of Liberty, Tyranny, and Sin. Now that's the article that I was thinking of. In this article, and again, I'll link to this on the page that this is located at badquaker.com. In this article, a general theory of liberty, tyranny, and sin, I attempt to make the argument that I was just now spouting about, that when man takes it upon himself to make laws for other men, he actually is partaking of that fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. He is the one becoming the judge of what is good and evil. Now, and then, so keeping that in mind, and please refer to that link found at badquaker.com for A General Theory of Liberty, Tyranny, and Sin. There's an audio file, or there's an actual printed file, and you can have a look at both of them. And the other one that I mentioned, Am I My Brother's Keeper? For whatever mad ramblings that you hear right now that I'm throwing at you, if you read those two articles, you'll see what I'm saying in sort of a sane, organized way, rather than just my angry shouts and proclamations. So now let's get more practical about this. I know a person who's very ill. And this person has reached the end of many years and has had a very successful life and a very happy life and a very tragic life. And like all of us, her life has faced ups and downs. And she is to the end of that battle and to the end of that path. And a close family member came over to visit her. And they were discussing some things. And this person went off on a discussion about the evils of alcohol. Now, let me just be specific. The woman that I'm talking about doesn't have a lot of time left on this earth. And this other person comes over who is supposedly, you know, churchgoer and all this kind of thing. And this person starts talking about the evils of alcohol. Now, keep in mind, alcohol is an inanimate object. It is not evil and it is not good any more than a tree branch or a rock. Well, even a tree branch is, you know, not inanimate, but a tree branch or a rock or a butterfly, these things have no good or evil, all right? And alcohol has no good or evil. What you do with it, like every other thing in the human experience, what you do with it, based on the human action involved, decides whether good or evil has taken place. But yet there are people in this world and in this earth and right here in the United States and right in my family who think it their place in the world, to push God off the throne and say, I'm the lawmaker. I'm the man who decides what's good and what's bad, and what is sin and what is not sin, and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. That is the height of sin. That is proclaiming yourself as God. That is blasphemy. That is Antichrist. That right there. Puritans. I was raised in a predominantly Baptist family with teetotalers in every direction. Teetotalers fanatical to the point that some of them refused to go into a bowling alley because they were convinced that if Jesus returned and you were in that bowling alley, you're just out of luck because he wasn't coming in that bowling alley after you. Or if you were in one of those sinful movie houses when Jesus returns, he's not coming in there for you. Really? Is that the kind of petty little filthy God you worship? I don't want anything to do with something like that. But that, and I don't say this to offend Baptists, there are really good Baptists out there. Several of them, probably. I can't actually say that as a fact, but I can assume it. However, anyone of any denomination who takes it upon themselves to make the laws for other people, that person is doing the exact thing that is the height of blasphemy. You are making yourself as a god. You're putting yourself on that throne as judge, and you are making yourself as a god. And it's really silly when you pick out an inanimate object like alcohol or marijuana or a gun or whatever the object is that you find terrifying or scary or to whatever extent that causes fear that someone might use it and maybe enjoy themselves or have some fun or who knows, scary things like that. No wonder you people are so afraid of things like alcohol or marijuana or, you know, whatever the substance or whatever the object is that fills you with fear, that you think, oh no, that person might have a gun, no, or he might have a brick. You know, a brick will kill you just as dead as a gun. Matter of fact, rocks have probably killed more people than bullets. Well, I don't know, the Khmer Rouge, they used a lot of rocks. They saved bullets. Anyway, so if I've said all this, and this rant is entirely babbling and makes no sense, please do me a favor. Go over to badquaker.com. Check out the links. One to the General Theory of Liberty, Tyranny, and Sin, and the other one to Am I My Brother's Keeper? And read through those in a calm fashion, not like what I'm talking now. And see for yourself if it doesn't make sense that when one human being takes it upon themselves to judge the behavior of another. Now, again, what we're speaking of is strictly within the zero aggression principle. If I'm sitting in my house, minding my own business, doing nothing to harm anyone else, and there's someone else on the other side of town who goes into a liquor store, key scary music, and buys alcohol. Dun, dun, dun. And perhaps this evil person has the audacity to do such an activity on a Sunday. Should I jump out of my house, run down the street, and attack this villain who's buying, or the monster who's selling the alcohol on a Sunday? Because, see, evidently, to people like who I'm talking about, let me just clarify. Not everyone realizes that there are barbaric areas of the United States where it's against the law to buy or sell alcohol on a Sunday. Perhaps people don't know that there are ridiculous places like Ohio where that's still those laws are still enacted. Now, it's true that there are ways to buy alcohol in Ohio on a Sunday. After all alcohol that's legally sold in Ohio is controlled entirely by the state of Ohio, because the state of Ohio is a fascist entity, and therefore it does that. But the entire concept that you have to have the permission of the government to buy or sell something, anything, fill in the blank, rocks, sticks, butterflies, alcohol, marijuana, heroin, doesn't matter. The fact that somebody has it in their mind, well, that needs to be authorized by the government. Why? What is the government? How does somehow this magic government know something that I don't know about my life? How is that? How does that make any sense? How did we come to this point where people, reasonable people, can listen to this argument that the government needs to control what I buy and what I sell? How did we get to the point of where that is a reasonable argument that's accepted publicly? And the answer is that America wasn't always like that. America didn't always accept ridiculous premises like that. The Puritans brought that to us. And I attacked the Baptists a little while ago. The Baptists gave up their own theologies and their own traditions in the early 1800s. As the Puritans, as their general doctrines and as their general theologies and as their reputation got worse and worse, as all these things fell apart that had given them the structure to control, because the Puritans love to control government. So as their control in theology and in government began to dissolve in the early 1800s, they shifted and decided that their best way would be to just infiltrate other church organizations and other political organizations and so forth. Now, in doing that, the mainstream Baptist just absorbed them right in. Most of the Baptist theological schools and so forth became polluted by Puritan concepts and ideas. And so by the mid-1800s, the Baptists were just as polluted by the Puritan desire to control the state and to use the state to manipulate people and to use the state to bring about the ultimate destiny that they wanted for themselves. That Puritan idea had pretty much polluted into most of the mainstream Baptists by that time. And by the late 1800s, it poured out into, you know, dozens of other established churches and denominations as well. So that the Pentecostals tend in this direction. Many of the, I could just sit here and start naming one after the other. But the real thing is, if you examine your own faith and your own beliefs and your own ideas, whether you're religious or not, even if you're not religious, if you've got it in your mind that you have to manipulate and control other people's behavior, whether or not that behavior actually affects you, if you believe that, because that's the problem with the progressives and the liberals as well. They can't possibly have someone out there, you know, having fun eating a nasty, fat-ridden hamburger or drinking a sugar-packed or actually it's not sugar, it's mostly high-fructose corn syrup-packed sweet drink that might have caffeine. The Puritan ideology and the Puritan mind frame has polluted all of those people to the point of where they all think that they need to regulate and tell us all, everybody else, what they can and can't do, all because it's what they think is best. And it's not a matter of person A does this, and therefore it affects person B. It's not like that. It's person A does this, and person B can't stand to see person A doing something that person B thinks is bad. And therefore person B thinks he has to interrupt what person A is doing. That's it right there. That's original sin. That is it. That is taking the position of God and judging another human being and saying that my decisions are more valid than your decisions. My opinion of fun is valid. Your opinion of fun or your opinion of what food is good or your opinion of what entertainment is good or your opinion of any of these things is offensive to me, even though what you do doesn't affect me. That right there, that's Puritanism in its purest form. And that is the origin of sin, and that's the origin of the state, and that's the origin of everything that is wrong in the world. Comes from that one thing, of one human being taking it upon themselves to lord over another human being, to become the god of that human being by demanding, by sitting on a throne and being the judge of that person's behavior. That's the origin. That's the origin of the state. And when we kill that, we kill the state. You can't kill the state by taking up arms against it. You can't kill the state by going out and waving signs and begging the state to give you some of your rights back. None of those things will do anything positive in the long run. You can't beat the state by getting involved in the state and getting elected and going in and changing the laws and fixing the economy. And none of those things will win the battle. You might have small, localized victories. You might see some progress in one level or another, but you will never overcome the wave that is the state. You can't do it through attempting to manipulate the state through the processes that drive the state. The only way to defeat the state is understanding what the state is and then refusing to be a part of it. Refusing to judge the other human. Refusing to say what that guy over there is doing is wrong, even though it doesn't affect me. Stop allowing yourself to do that. We'll go back to the theology thing. Think about, they found this woman. They had this woman. She was caught, they said, actually in the act. Caught in the act of prostitution. And they drug her to Jesus. And they said, okay, the law says we're supposed to stone her. And what did Jesus do about it? He squatted down and started drawing with his finger in the sand. And he said, whoever's without sin, cast the first stone. And one by one, they all walked away, and they left the woman sitting there. Because who among them could judge her? And yet that's what they were doing. Were they actually affected by her prostitution? Did her making a living as a prostitute, did that in some way affect those self-righteous? Not in the least. She was just a woman making a living. And you may not like what she did. You may not approve of what she was doing. But it's none of your business. None. Okay. If I keep talking about this, I'll put the whole hour on this topic. I will. You watch me. I'll do it. Okay, let's get to some news before I just completely lose my entire audience here. I've already attacked several large religious groups. If I isolate all the Southern Baptists that might be listening to me, I'm not going to have very many people left in the South that are listening. Remember, folks, Puritanism, no matter what your denomination, Puritanism is a state of mind. It's not a specific denomination. It's as common among the atheists, it's as common among the progressives on the left, it's common among the liberals, it's common among the right wing, it's common among conservatives, it's common among every political group, and it's common among every religious group, and every non-religious group. That seed of destruction that is Puritanism, that drives a person to want to be a busybody and tell somebody else how to live their lives. It's not about religion. It's not about politics. It's about overcoming an evil aspect that has invaded human nature and that we, as humans, must make a conscious effort to reject from our minds. And then the state dies. Okay, here's a fun thing. This is for all those who think... This is for all those who think that everything's fine with the U.S. government. It just has some oddities. It just needs to be tweaked a little bit. We just need to adjust it just a little bit. There was a guy. Now, I've talked about him before, but it's been a while. There was a guy who was living in Colorado, and he's a citizen of the United States of America. He's an American, and he's living in Colorado. And on his website, he translated some stuff that was written in Thai. He translated that. Now, I can't remember actually if he translated something that was written in Thai into English or if he translated something that was in English into Thai. I can't actually remember. But one way or the other, what he translated was critical of the monarchy of Thailand. Now, if you're unfamiliar with Thailand, Thailand has a sort of a two-headed government. They have their king, they have their monarch, and many of the people there hold this human in a very high regard. And then they have the government, which is separate from the monarchy. In that sense, it's kind of like England, except people in England are more fascinated with their royalty and don't actually worship them. It's still pretty disgusting, but it's, you know, but at least they don't worship the royalty in England. Well, most of them anyway. But in Thailand, their opinion of their monarch is quite illogical. And so this individual, this American citizen, this person living in Colorado, he wrote these things on his website. And so one thing led to the other, and now he is in custody in Thailand, jailed, and he's expected to get, I believe it's 2.5 years in prison in Thailand for defaming the country's royal family, because he translated excerpts of a banned biography of Thailand's king. I'll put the link to this. This story is coming from Associated Press. This is the current update of the story. But I've talked about this before. This has been going on for years now, that this has been going back and forth. And basically, Washington, D.C., just handed him over to them. You see, people who make the argument that, well, the government's necessary for some things, and one of the things that they always make the argument that the government is necessary for is so that we can have peaceful relationships with other governments. That's like saying, well, the Crips are necessary because if you didn't have the Crips around, how would you communicate with the Bloods? How about if we just don't have any gangs? How about if none of us have any gangs? Wouldn't that be better? But anyway, so people who make the argument that we have to have the state to do these things for us because people wouldn't do them on their own and these other governments would do this and that. Well, here we have a situation where an American is in jail in a foreign country because of words he put on, non-threatening words he put on his website from his home in Colorado. And now he's in jail. So let's see, how well does that state protect us? Well, let's see, how well does the state protect us? If you haven't heard it, Lou Rockwell has a wonderful podcast, and a few weeks back he had Gerald Celente on his podcast. Now, I'm of two minds on Gerald Celente. First off, sometimes he's entertaining to listen to, because listening to somebody go nuts the way I kind of did in the first half of this podcast, sometimes that's entertaining, and Gerald Celente can be entertaining. The problem is Gerald Celente is kind of a one-trick pony. He does one thing. He proclaims the coming destruction of the world, and after a while it starts to get to be, you know, I don't know. The first time I heard the band Boston, it was like, hey, that's a catchy tune they're playing there. But when I realized that every single song that Boston played sounded exactly alike, I kind of lost my interest in the band Boston. Of course, that, you know, that's for us old people. That was 30, 35 years ago that took place. But Gerald Celente's kind of like that. He kind of, you hear him so often. It's like the boy that cried wolf. You just hear him so often harping on the same destruction's coming, that you really start to get numb to it. But if you listen to Lou Rockwell's podcast, and I'll put a link to this one too. It's Lou Rockwell's podcast number 237, Prepare for an Economic 9/11 and Economic Martial Law with Gerald Celente. What you hear in this is Gerald Celente's frustration because Gerald had trusted a certain aspect of the futures market and the Chicago mercantile market. And they essentially just notified him and took all his money. They did it in an entirely illegal fashion, and they did it in an entirely immoral fashion, a way that has never been done in history, ever, that they would do such a thing. And they did this, and Gerald Celente's freaking out about it. Although if you listen to Gerald Celente's advice from a couple of years ago, he shouldn't have been in that market anyway because the market was unstable and was bound to do this at some time. But this brings us to another person who, listening to her speak, is a lot more stable than Gerald Celente. And I'll put a link to this one, too. This file is called Ann Barnhart, The Entire Futures Options Market Has Been Destroyed by the MF Global Collapse. And in her, in this, this is coming from Financial Sense. And as you hear her describe what's going on, she's going to say radical, well, she does say radical stuff in this file that, you know, you'd think you were hearing me say it because it's crazy stuff about how the government is an illegal entity that's just acting on its own. And she just says some really, really solid stuff. But if you get past the emotion, what she's really saying is that a massive scandal has happened and people from the Goldman Sachs camp have essentially looted massive amounts of the American market. And the government is in on it, and they're not going to do anything about it. And, oh, there may be a scapegoat. There may be a Bernie Madoff somewhere that gets some blame for this. But essentially, literally trillions of dollars have gone out of the pockets of Americans and into the pockets of a very small group of individuals that are all connected to the same little group of people, many of them having something to do with Goldman Sachs. Now, And almost all of them having directly to do with the government, directly to do with not only, I'm not going to sit here and bash the Obama administration because the Bush administration sat through this exactly the same thing happening in 2008. Do you remember that? Well, what happened in the last 2 months in the Chicago market is as massive as what took place in the housing market in 2008. The difference is, because the Chicago market is so complex and hard to figure out in every way, it doesn't make the kind of headlines that the housing market, the housing bubble market collapsing made. So the mainstream media is staying silent, partly because they're the mainstream media and they have a vested interest in keeping all this quiet. Secondly, because it's a very complicated issue that's too much for the little sound blips that they throw on in 2.5 minutes on the television for people to hear. So you're probably not going to hear much about it, or if you hear anything about it in mainstream media, it's going to be washed out. It's going to be really washed down to the point of where it's not going to make any sense. But take a look at the link for Gerald Celente and listen to Lou Rockwell and Gerald Celente talking about this. If you haven't heard it already, if you're a listener on the Liberty Radio Network, you probably heard Lou Rockwell talk about it because his podcast is on prior to mine. But this was from a couple weeks ago, so you may not have caught it. And then catch the link that I also put at badquaker.com to Financial Sense. Scroll down to that part with Ann Barnhart and listen to her talking about this in the interview. She really lays it out in a scary fashion, in a way that's, and she knows what she's talking about. You can tell this woman, she knows what she's talking about. Now, I've got a couple other, I just checked the time there to make sure I was doing okay. I've got a couple other things I wanted to talk about. One is I was so happy to see, over the weekend on LouRockwell.com that, Michael Rozoff has rang in on the what he calls the neo-greenbackers. Now, for a while now, I felt like I was the only one out there ringing the bell, calling for action, saying these greenbackers are, you know, they're everywhere. I think I've linked to Gary North over and over because Gary North is like the, you know, he's the knight in shining armor when it comes to battling the greenbackers. But a lot of Gary North's stuff is hard to get to. It's behind firewalls and it's behind membership-only links, so it's really hard to get in there unless you're paying $15 a month or whatever it is to be on Gary North's site. It's really difficult to get in there and find Gary North really talking about the Greenbackers. So I was kind of feeling like I was on my own out here, you know, just jousting against a dragon by myself. And so to run across this article on Lou Rockwell was really a refreshing thing to find over the weekend. I just ate that up. It was like, yeah, here comes the cavalry. I can rest a little bit. I felt like, going back to the biblical thing, there's a passage that about one of King David's personal guard that was one of his, what it called, mighty men. And in one of them, it refers to him as swinging the sword in battle to the point of where his hand cleaved to the sword. He literally, his hand was cramped up from swinging the sword. He had gripped it so long that he couldn't let go of the sword. And I've started to feel that way with the Greenbackers, like I've been out there whacking at these people to the point of where my muscles are just cramping up and I just... I'm about to collapse of exhaustion at whacking at him. So it was so nice to find that Michael Rozoff has taken on the Greenbackers and is out there on Lou Rockwell and has taken some of the heat for me. And I say for me, he doesn't know I exist, but, you know, I appreciate him taking on this battle anyway. And he is such a good writer anyway. All his stuff, I recommend everything he's got over there at LouRockwell.com. He has a very extensive file at Lou Rockwell with a lot of good stuff on it. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was an event that took place over the weekend with the Oath Keepers. There was, in the latter part of last week, there was an email that was circulating around. It was becoming a viral email, and it was also popping up at posting boards and at forums all over the internet. And the basic idea of the email was that the Oath Keepers were reporting that federal agents, and it was a little vague on who these federal agents were, but federal agents had arrived at a Tennessee Mormon cannery. And if you're not familiar with the Mormon canneries, the Mormons have a very, very pragmatic look at a very pragmatic view about storing food in case of disasters or in case of bad things that might or will come upon us at some point in the future. And so they believe in having a storage of food in supply in case almost for the almost certainty that at some point in time we will need it. And so, and in doing this, Mormons are, at these Mormon food canneries, are more than happy to share their methods, to sell their stuff, and to help other people learn how to get food stored up for when you have bad times. So the way the story was portrayed with the Oath Keepers was that federal agents had gone to a Mormon cannery, which is an aspect of their church. They're usually run right out of the Mormon church, oftentimes out of the basement of the church. But anyway, the story was that federal agents had gone to a Mormon cannery and demanded a list of people who had done business with them, people who were buying bulk food and storing food in bulk. Now, this is, first off, this is very believable because the feds, the nasty, stinking Homeland Security people, have made comments before about one of the signs of that somebody might be a terrorist is if they're storing amounts of food. As ridiculous as that may seem, somehow that's made the official lists as something that people should watch for. As suspicious activity that, you know, that you would store up food in case that you needed in some kind of disaster. So that makes this story believable when you start to hear it. And knowing that Homeland Security people and IMF and all these other people have gone into all kinds of businesses and just done amazingly draconian things in the past already, to hear that they have gone into a Mormon food cannery, it's believable. And that's the really scary part about this. The problem is in the Oath Keepers email, and for a while it was on their website. I don't know if it still is. I haven't been over there recently, but through most of the weekend on the Oath Keepers website, it portrayed this email as being true. And the email even contained a person's name that had supposedly verified this as a high member of the Oath Keepers. And the entire thing was a hoax. It was all false, every bit of it. None of it happened. I'll put a link on this page on Bad Quaker to the YouTube account of Southern Belle Prepper, which is a lady who is there in Tennessee, and she made the effort to actually go down and speak with the people at the Mormon cannery to see if anybody had done this, and they entirely debunked it. They said, no, nobody has done this. This has not taken place. We don't know how the story went around, but this just simply didn't take place. And if somebody was to come and ask us for a list, first off, we don't have a list, and second, we wouldn't give them a list if we had a list. So the entire story is fake. Now, here's what strikes me about it. How is it that this story got out in an email from the Oath Keepers, and how is it that it was on Oath Keepers' website for so long that panicked so many people and got so many people upset? I was upset. How is it that the Oath Keepers could allow a hoax like this to be pulled? Was the hoax actually done by the Oath Keepers to draw attention to themselves? I find that highly unlikely. But at the same time, how is it that they allowed themselves to be taken in by something like this? Who would do this hoax? Well, I can think of a number of entities who would like to discredit the Oath Keepers. I can think of a number of entities that would love nothing better than to show the Oath Keepers as a bunch of reactionary hotheads that really are detached and don't really, you know what's going on, and they're just crazy right-wing nuts. I can think of a number of agencies and entities that would like to portray them as such. And if the Oath Keepers don't realize that there are groups out there that would like to paint them that direction, then I'd have to think the Oath Keepers are rather naive. And if the Oath Keepers do understand this, that there are groups out there that would love to paint them as being right-wing nut radicals, and they did nothing to prepare for this kind of a smear campaign, then, guess what? Welcome to the Internet. Did you know there are things on the Internet that are fake? Did you know that there are people on the Internet that will try to discredit you? Did you know that, Oath Keepers? Did you know that you have to be careful on the Internet? Did you know that when you put your name on something and put it out for other people, your name carries a certain amount of weight with it? When I saw the Oath Keepers were saying this in an email, first I thought, okay, and I put I repeated the story carefully by just quoting a piece of it and saying, this, what's going on with this? But then when I found out that it was actually on the Oath Keepers website, I actually linked to it because I trusted the Oath Keepers. You think I'm going to trust the Oath Keepers again? The next time a big story comes up like this, you think I'm going to trust the Oath Keepers? Well, probably not. The Oath Keepers lost my trust. But then again, I didn't have a lot of trust in the Oath Keepers anyway, because, now check this out. The premise of the Oath Keepers is that they are former or active emergency personnel, police, law enforcement, military, and so forth, that are dedicated to the Constitution. Have you read that thing? There are so many loopholes. You could pretty much drive a truck through any of the first 10 amendments. And once you get past the first 10 amendments, the whole rest of the Constitution is just legal babble anyway. I mean, honestly. Just think about it. I've done articles before on when the Constitution died, and when did that take place? About the time it was written. consider George Mason the foundational liberty-minded individual of his day, a kind of a guy who had the vision of liberty that he could actually go to Jefferson and say, Jefferson, you're wrong, and show him why he was wrong. That's George Mason. George Mason wouldn't have anything to do with the Constitution. Check that out for yourself, and you'll see. When they asked George Mason to go to the Continental Convention and discuss the Constitution, he wouldn't have anything to do with it. They begged him. The local people begged him to go and represent them. And he's like, I'm not having anything to do with that thing. Not touching it. Check the story out for yourself. So I don't have a lot of faith in the Constitution because the Constitution failed almost as soon as it was written. The Constitution failed over and over and over. The Constitution never did what they told us it was supposed to do. Take the Second Amendment, for instance. The Second Amendment says the right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Infringed. So did that happen? Has the Second Amendment protected our rights? Not in the least. I can prove that by simply putting on a gun on my hip and walking down the street in a state where I live, where it's perfectly legal to put a gun on your hip and walk down the street. I guarantee that if I walked around in my own town, open carrying, I would have some serious harassment over it. Whether or not I could beat them in court is not the question. The word said infringed. Let's consider that word infringed. If I have a piece of property, if I have a piece of land, and somebody comes up to that piece of land, and they pull, let's say, a dump truck right into the middle of my land, and they dump a bunch of, old tires. They dump a whole dump truck load of old tires right in the middle of my land. Guess what? They have not infringed upon me. They have not infringed upon my land. They dumped tires on my land. But how about this? How about if my neighbor's tree has a limb, and that limb overhangs my property by a foot? That's infringement. What if there's a guy walking along the property line, and his foot comes onto my property? That's infringement. Now, if you read the Second Amendment, and then you try to weigh that out and consider what kind of gun laws there are in the United States and what kind of knife laws there are in the United States, and whether or not I can walk around and go from one place to another, secure in myself and in my possessions and in my papers and in my communications and in my weaponry. If I can go from place to place in the United States without being harassed, then I'm wrong. And you constitutionalist people are right. But you know that's not the case, and it hasn't been the case for a very long time. As a matter of fact, wasn't it the second president that pushed through the Alien and Sedition Act? Wasn't that the second president who said you can't even say anything, or print anything bad about the president or the Congress? Wasn't that the second president that did that? Wasn't Jefferson so afraid of the Alien and Sedition Act that he was hesitant to even write letters to his friends about his opinion of what was going on? Now you tell me. You're going to swear an oath to the Constitution to protect and serve the Constitution. The Constitution failed 250 years ago. What have you people been up to? How bad do you want to wait until it fails? You talk a big talk. You're a bunch of internet tough guys. That's all you are. But let's get back to the real point. Using threat of arms or using arms themselves is not the way to defeat the United States government. And it's certainly not the way to defeat the state. If you want to defeat the state, you take my advice from earlier. You defeat the state that's in your mind. Throw out the belief that's in your mind that the state is the answer, that the state is that it exists. Throw it out. Take that Puritan root that's in your mind and rip it out by the roots and toss it aside. And decide in your mind that you will follow the zero aggression principle. that you will not aggress on anyone. And if no one aggresses on you, then you will not try to get into their business and make them do what you think is right and wrong. That brings the defeat of the state. And nothing short of that will work. We have tremendous weapons. We have free market trade. We have free market activities. We have Agora. I've talked about that before. The open trading and the black markets and all these things are our weapons. But deep inside the mind of each human, we have to understand that the state is a figment of our imagination. And when we choose not to be our brother's keeper, when we as a species choose not to be our brother's keeper, the state vanishes. Folks, thanks for listening to BadQuaker.com. Be sure and check out our website, BadQuaker.com. Send feedback to me, Ben@BadQuaker.com. For more on liberty, property rights, and the zero aggression principle, go to BadQuaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks. Am I my brother's keeper? Caution, Bad Quaker theology class is now in session. Please note, atheists, pagans, non-Christian theists, and agnostics are welcome to sit in and ring in with your opinion and your observations. Genesis chapter 4. And Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bare Cain, and said, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And she again bare his brother Abel, and Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. And in process of time it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering, but unto Cain and to his offering he had no respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth, and why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. Am I my brother's keeper? Am I my brother's keeper? According to Christian tradition, these are the words that Cain threw in the face of God when God asked Cain what happened to his brother. Of course, in the context of the story, God knew what happened to Cain's brother, but Cain's defense was a legitimate one nonetheless. Let's stop before we go too far. What I'm asking the reader to do is consider the Cain-Abel case as a lesson in morality, to look at the facts provided in the story and draw a conclusion, not a conclusion of guilt or innocence, but a conclusion as to one possible moral of this story. The undisputed facts. Two brothers, Cain the elder, Abel the younger. Cain is a farmer, Abel is a shepherd. Cain is jealous of Abel and kills him. God knows of the deed and confronts Cain by asking a leading question. Cain does not bite the bait, utilizes a legitimate defense, and demands God show his hand. God concedes to Cain's valid point and presents his case directly. Cain admits guilt, asks for mercy, and is punished for murder by banishment and shunning. Like any good investigator, God confronted Cain by asking a question he already knew the answer to. Quote, Where is Abel thy brother? Cain wisely responded, quote, Am I my brother's keeper? And God is forced to present his whole case to Cain. God shows that he knows where the body is and the method and the motive for the crime. Cain confesses, God pronounces punishment. So now that the facts are out of the way, let's consider one moral of the story. As a child, Sunday school teachers and pulpit preachers told me that the moral of the story was that we are our brother's keeper. We are responsible for our brother's actions. It's up to us to protect, convert, and redeem our brothers. It's up to us to see to it that our brother is not ensnared by sin. The inference was that our own salvation was in part dependent on how hard we worked to see to it that our brother was kept from sinning. Yet this twisted Puritan distortion of the story could not be more wrong. We are not our brother's keeper. Our brother is not our keeper. We do not own our brother, and neither does he own us. Therefore, he is responsible for his actions, and we are responsible for our actions. If it were otherwise, God would have countered Cain's rebuke by saying that he was indeed his brother's keeper. But he made no such remark. Cain's point was valid, and God moved on to other evidence. If Cain were Abel's keeper, and therefore responsible for him, it would follow that Abel was responsible for Cain, and therefore Abel would be at least in part responsible for his own murder. That sounds just like Puritan thinking. Blame the victim of the crime for the crime. Shift the blame anywhere except to the guilty party. What next? Blame an inanimate object like the murder weapon? There's a theology the Puritans and the progressives would love. Blame the assault rock that Cain used to crush Abel's head. So all we have to do is to assure no assault rocks are available to commit crimes, and no one will sin, and we can all go to heaven. So the moral, as I see it, is that each and every one of us is responsible for ourselves and our own actions, and no one is responsible for anyone but himself or herself. To take this one step further, let's think about the murder. Cain killed out of envy. Cain envied what Abel had, to the point he would rather kill Abel than to allow him to live with something that Cain could not have. Clearly, envy, taken to its logical end, is about more than just possessing something that someone else has. It also has to do with denying to someone what we can't possess. So an example of this would be the evil school teacher who sees that one child in the class has gum. So he singles out the child and demands to know if she has enough gum for the whole class. When she admits that she does not, he demands she spit out her gum. He is teaching envy to the other children in the class. Better to punish the one little girl than allow her to enjoy her property in the presence of those who lack the item. The logical conclusion I draw from this is that the desire to control, manipulate, dominate, prohibit, regulate, and manage the affairs of others is in its essence an aspect of envy. Envy, along with greed, is the driving force of the state. Bertrand Russell made a similar case in defining envy in his book, The Conquest of Happiness, but he saw this aspect of envy as a positive trait and said that democracy itself cannot function without it. He went so far as to say that this aspect of envy is the driving force of democracy. I would agree with his conclusion, except I see absolutely nothing but evil in the existence of democracy. Democracy is an aspect of socialism, and socialism is the economic system that all states exist by. So, am I my brother's keeper? The moment I become my brother's keeper, my brother becomes my slave. I am morally against slavery. Therefore, I am an enemy of the state. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.